Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and with me I have...
Hi, it's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And it's the first time we're all sitting together in 4 weeks.
Yeah, it's a month. I was gone for 32 days.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Over the time you were gone, I don't know if you've noticed, we've gotten a lot more commenters.
Yes.
In that time.
Yes. I have been trying to follow as best I can because I haven't been online as much as I normally am.
Right.
But I love like seeing stuff commented upon on Facebook and stuff like that and stuff that you've sent out. And it's great. It's a conversation. They're starting a conversation with us.
Well, we asked in our last episode whether our listeners felt Chio could have been removed from the season.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not overwhelming, but it was definitely the majority said, yes, she could have been removed from the season without affecting it in really any way. And then we could have gotten more Potsy and maybe an explanation of this relationship between Alana and Margot that is a real relationship, not just a hookup.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot we missed. There was a lot going on behind the scenes.
Other mentions, you know, we have our fact checker, which we love. It could have been a plastic wine glass in Hannibal's cell. You know, it could have been. I have acrylic wine glasses that because I am prone to break wine glasses. So, okay, I'll go along with that. And they pointed out that the only way he could really do damage with that is if he had a lighter. And if they're giving him access to a lighter, really somebody needs to be taken care of here.
Someone's falling asleep on the job at that point.
And then Martha De Laurentiis herself, or someone posing as Martha De Laurentiis on the De Laurentiis Company Twitter, confirmed this is my design, which I don't know that I buy it. Just because it said it in the script, just because it said it in, I mean, he says it so differently than he has ever said it before.
Yeah.
I don't understand why it would be said so weird. Why the director, if it was, this is my design, wouldn't have said, hey, can we try that again? It sounds like you said isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or at least you weren't enunciating all the way.
And I mean, we had Kate on last week who was adamant that it was this is my design, then listened to it again and was adamant on her show that it is this isn't my design.
Ooh.
So really, I mean, yeah, they may tell us that it is this is my design, but I don't know.
It was at least unclear enough to cause question and therefore had to be, you know, publicly stated. This is actually what we meant for him to say. But the way it came out, maybe not.
Now that said, I was unable to locate the tweet that confirmed this, supposedly.
Oh,
I had a number of people tweeting at me that it was confirmed, but I have not been able to find.
You didn't find the
De Laurentiis Co.
tweet
that said that.
People
so.
Playing telephone on Twitter.
So those are our catch-up notes. I mean, we did get a lot of responses to, especially the last episode. Like, we get a page worth of point-by-point responses.
Which is awesome.
Which is awesome. Tonight, we are talking about Season 3, Episode 9, and The Woman Clothed with the Sun, directed by John Dahl, written by Jeff Laming and Helen Chang, and Brian Fuller and Steve Lightfoot.
Of course.
I would be surprised if they didn't just polish every episode thoroughly.
Yeah, I think they really need to have their hand in everything, but it's a good thing.
So before we get started with this episode, though, Miko, you didn't get an opportunity to talk to us about episode 8, The Great Red Dragon.
No, and it was crazy because I was somewhere where I had internet access, but no way to actually watch the episode. So I had to wait till I got back. I kept trying to. It was like, oh, and I have to stay overnight in a hotel on the way home. There'll be Wi-Fi there, and I'll watch it there.
And if it was anywhere near as good as your Wi-Fi was, the other hotel you stayed in.
Every Wi-Fi I had from that first hotel room was infinitely better. It was the crappiest Wi-Fi ever. We just kept getting in late and didn't have any time. So it was tough. I actually didn't watch it till like a week later and got to watch it here, which was great. Back on a big screen. I've been watching it on my laptop or on an iPad. Not the best way to watch this show.
This show does not have the same impact.
No, no. Watched, you know, although it kind of helps if you do it in pitch black.
But with headphones on, I imagine, I did it with headphones. Headphone experience really works for the show.
It does. It does. And you hear more of the music.
Yeah.
You hear more nuance. I liked that, listening to it with headphones,
you
like in the dark.
You might be able to tell if he said, this is my design, this isn't my design.
The one episode I didn't listen with headphones. Although, from what I remember, I thought it was, this is my design. Yeah. So when I heard it initially. But I was blown away. I was absolutely blown away. I thought Florence was beautifully shot.
Yeah.
Until I saw this episode. And it's made everything they had done previously just not even seem as spectacular. Even though it is still beautiful, that this episode was mind-blowing. It was beautiful. The transitions, the way they used the mind palace, the memory palace scenes intermixed with the real scenes, the way they used reflection, the way they reintroduced the, you know, we now have, the, you know, the tableaus, which I've missed. We now have Price and Seller, which I missed.
Yes.
Oh, like ecstatic to see them back, you know, doing a kind of like a funny, almost Twin Peaks-esque, you know.
Oh, well, when Price comes in, you immediately turned to me and said, Albert.
Albert, totally.
From Twin Peaks, because he has that line that is very much an Albert line. The, I was told I was coming. Were you not told?
Were you not told? Exactly. And that way he kind of talks down to him like, well, do you have anybody?
You're just a backcountry guy.
Yeah, I don't think you can really help me, but is there anybody that, I don't know, has like an inkling of a thought that might be able to, you know, to help me? And then
basic competency.
Yeah. So it was wonderful. It was absolutely just spectacular to see what they did with this. And I think this second half of this season is going to be delicious every step of the way.
So I did not expect to get Abigail Hobbs in this episode.
I don't think anybody was.
And I was thrilled that our first glimpse of her happened before the opening credits, so I didn't get the spoiler alert guest starring Casey Rawl on the screen.
The giveaway.
What did you think about this? This feels late in the game. It was good information, but is it anything that we didn't already know?
It was really interesting, because especially after we had a really hard time with how they dealt with certain characters in the Florence episodes, how some people didn't get enough time, and we thought that they were extra characters. To have this rich second half, but have this character that we're like, do we really need time with this? Mm. When there's so much wonderful stuff going on. We are learning some interesting things. I like their dialogue. I like what they're talking about. It doesn't seem to, it's not directly related to like what's going on with Dalaran. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're learning a whole lot there. We're not getting, I think, a whole lot of insight into the serial killer mindset. But what I find interesting about it is the talk about family when Will now has a family. And I think the reason why it's put in here.
Yeah, thematically, that's what this entire episode is about. It's Will's family. Dalaran finding family and finding families, mm-hmm. and Hannibal's attempts to create family. Yeah.
So it doesn't leave that whole idea of, I gave you a child,
right?
Which was kind of creepy and Mason-esque.
Like we could have had a child, Will.
Exactly.
This is Hannibal at his best, jilted ex.
Yes.
Mode here.
Yeah, like we could have had this. And I think going back, it's almost like this was the family he was trying to build. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to pull Abigail sort of out of what she thought her family was and who her father was, to sort of accept him and Will. He was making that place for her, mm-hmm. until all went awry at the dinner.
I think it's so odd that, I mean, we come back with Abigail asking Hannibal if he's going to kill her and how many people has Hannibal killed, and we get I've killed many more than your father. But the interesting part here is Abigail asks Hannibal how he would have murdered her, and immediately he's, I would have cut your throat, like your father.
Like your father, yeah.
And I really like that you accepted your father. Will it be so difficult to accept me? Mm. There's a very deep manipulation happening here, especially as they're preparing for this blood ritual, because blood rituals involve symbolic death and rebirth. So yeah. Abigail Hobbs gets to die to leave behind the speculation and the murder. This was just after she killed the guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so then this is Hannibal's way of protecting her, is to kill her so she can be reborn as a sycophantic follower of the Church of Hannibal Lecter.
Exactly. The Hannibal family. I don't know how they're going to like live. I guess they were going to disappear somewhere, I don't know, in Brazil or something, and live as a family. I have no idea what his idea of how he's going to live with his family from here. But it's interesting how she evolves in that conversation, mm-hmm. because she's terrified at the beginning. You have this sort of feeling like she feels like she's going to die, and then it evolves as they talk. And while she's talking to him about like the symbolic death and rebirth, and he talks about how you can't predict who you will be tomorrow, the more their conversation continues, she goes from having a frightened expression to having an expression of almost bemusement.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's after that exchange that was very much father little girl thing about collecting the flesh, not a pound, only a piece. And I couldn't bear to take your fingers; they're so lovely.
They're so lovely, and I wanted to teach you.
Yeah, it is probably the most fatherly Hannibal ever appears, mm-hmm. because it's this almost cute little playful thing he's doing, and that was jarring to me that he was and about something so awful, because we know he's going to take her ear after mm-hmm. he tucks her hair behind her ear.
Yep.
And
like, I'll take this.
Yeah. But then Abigail immediately takes her part in this this tableau by asking to push the button, because blood leaves the body at a gallop and then a stumble.
And then a stumble, yes.
And the sequence of him embracing her from behind,
yes.
while she sprays her blood all over the kitchen.
And that the slow motion blood hitting
everything. Well, it wouldn't be Hannibal if there wasn't slow motion blood.
True. And that sort of ecstatic expression on her face.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, we're seeing the Abigail Hobbs that ultimately had no problem with what her father was doing. Mm-hmm. We've seen the Abigail Hobbs that had a problem with it and was frightened by it. We haven't seen much of the one who's just like, yeah, I kind of enjoy this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He really tapped into that.
Tapped the vein.
Oh, yeah. Especially when I believe he, I forget what he asks her, but her response is, I don't know if it would be wise. And she does this slow little smile that reminded me of the way Hannibal smiles mm-hmm. when people say things that, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm curious about that. Ooh, yeah. You know, it's like, oh, keep going. You're pretty evil and I'm liking it. And she did a very similar smile. And it was almost like this was her becoming, like, he was, by being very fatherly and talking about, you know, what she grew up with and who he was and how people evolve, that by the time you get to this ecstatic moment of them, of him wrapped, his arms wrapped around her, she's gone full boat over.
Oh, yeah.
He's got her. Abigail Hobbs is dead. Long live Abigail Hobbs.
Yeah.
I like that. That was... It was very triumphant, very glib,
mm-hmm.
because we've seen a huge transition of this character from terrified to, let's do this.
Well, I wonder if that terror isn't in part, we're going to get caught. That, not necessarily that could be, terror at the act, but the terror of what if we are found out? And then she's slowly realizing, well, he did say he killed more than my father, and he's still buddy-buddy with the FBI.
Yeah.
So if anybody can get away with it and
maybe
keep
Hannibal
doing
can
it,
do this?
It's probably him. So yeah. Maybe this could be fun because we're actually not going to live in fear of being caught. Because
exactly.
He's found out or found a way to continue killing without ending in jail.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody can do it, Hannibal can.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He is a magic man. So Abigail is blindfolded in our next scene
yes.
with her. And Hannibal puts a bone knife under her nose and is talking about how we can instinctively sense and smell our own family,
yeah. Mm-hmm. We can detect each other from smell alone, which was this whole scene reminded me of how Chio was also would have things burned,
mm-hmm.
and she would have to smell it. It's like it's a kind of an interesting ritual of his. Maybe you know, linked to
he's
his
looking for another smell person.
That yeah.
I'm
like
sure
a
there's
super taster,
a,
yeah. a super
but
smeller.
but a smell
super smeller.
Person,
super smeller,
super smeller. That's what he's looking for. That yeah. Hannibal wants nothing more in the world than another super smeller like himself.
Exactly. It's a small club.
I bet he stands outside on a fall day and says, I smell rain.
Yes.
Smell rain.
I smell.
Well, I mean, not anymore. He doesn't stand outside
doesn't,
on
no,
a fall day.
No. Well, who knows? He's got a very strong sense of smell. He may
he
be
might,
able
he
to
he
smell.
Smell it through the vents.
Yeah.
Yeah. He stands at those little circles in the glass and.
So Abigail immediately knows her father made this knife without even looking at it.
I like the disgust in her voice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When she talks about it.
Like, my father made this out of bone.
Exactly. That tone when she said it.
I thought, so this is a weird aesthetic thing. And I'm curious what our listeners think, because Francis Dolaride in Manhunter has a very, very distinctly, oddly patterned silk shirt. And Abigail Hobbs' silk shirt in this scene reminded me so much of that weirdly patterned silk shirt. So I'm curious what our listeners think about that.
Let me, I didn't get a chance to look at it. Oh, wow. You're good.
Oh, yeah. You're
I mean, I know her shirt is not this pattern. Because it's more of a floral pattern.
Yeah, it looks like leaves, actually.
But
honestly,
the
it looked
the
like
fact...
pieces of pizza when I was looking at it. I don't know.
Maybe you're just
maybe I was
hungry.
Maybe.
But
I love
I mean, Dolaride's, I'll put this picture on the show notes. But Dolaride's shirt is like a dark blue, and it has almost this burned-in browns and tans in patterns on it. And I just immediately thought of that when I saw Abigail's
shirt. It's been so long since I've seen Manhunter. I specifically did not go back.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched Manhunter. I only watched that first couple of minutes of Red Dragon.
Right.
And now I feel like I need to go back.
But we're going to watch that after the season.
Exactly. But I was. It is amazing that you were able to catch that. Because that it is amazing. It is
it's
large...
that obsessiveness.
Yes. I thought it was interesting that it looked like leaves.
Yeah.
You know, especially since they're talking about hunting and where they're at. And the images of her hunting with her father were out in the woods. I didn't know if that was the reason why it was chosen is because it had that kind of outdoors or not really camouflage, but kind of like that idea, mm-hmm. like a duck blind or kind of, mm-hmm. you know, it just had, if it had kind of a connection to that in any way.
Well, here in this scene, we see Abigail essentially giving over the father role to Hannibal. She talks about how her father cut her throat, which Hannibal says out of love.
Because that's what you do.
Because every family loves differently. This is Hannibal trying to convince himself that his little family can work. Every family's different.
Oh, yeah.
No one's normal.
We're all little snowflakes.
Yeah. You know, you, me, and Will. It'll be great.
Right.
When Hannibal removes the blindfold, okay.
Well, first he asks, can she smell her father there?
And it's Garrett Jacob Hobbs, but not imaginary Garrett Jacob Hobbs that Will has seen. It's
fresh from the coffin.
I mean, okay, so it's been a long time since I've read Hannibal. But in Hannibal, doesn't Hannibal do this to Clarice? Doesn't he bring Clarice's father's corpse to her? Or does he just dress up like her father? He does something weird with her father so Clarice can get over it.
That's when she's drugged.
Yeah.
Why can't there? I read this last year.
I think he dresses as her father, like, and he's a police officer.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's what it is.
So Hannibal
too.
Dresses like?
Not a police officer, it was a night watchman.
Yeah.
I think he puts on a uniform.
Okay. I remembered something vividly about that.
But that's
that.
While she's under hallucinogenic drugs.
Well, and we don't know. Abigail may well be dramatically drugged in this sequence here.
It wouldn't be the first time he gave her hallucinogens.
Yes. I like the way Hannibal takes away his power with this is all of him now. This is what death has reduced him to.
Mm-hmm.
But Abigail surprised me by saying that hunting with him was the best time she ever had, and that he was as good to her as he knew how to be. That strikes me, he was as good to me as he knew how to be, strikes me as the kind of thing Hannibal would say to justify the love that he hopes to get. You know, it's like your dad did all he could, now I can do better.
Mm.
Yes. So, you don't have to raise your hand.
Oh, I didn't want to interrupt with information about something we'd already talked about.
Okay.
But I had looked something up. I don't have the exact quote from the book.
Okay.
But apparently in someone's writing, when they're analyzing the book, it says, an apparent cure also replaces invasion in Lecter's act of literally digging up Clarice's father's body in order for her to come to terms with her dead, with his dead presence.
Okay.
To move beyond her Electra complex.
Now, Clarice's father would have been far more disrepair at this moment.
Wouldn't have been much left at all. Like, it would be bone and maybe
he died when she was 8 or 9, I think. All right. But he did also dress as her father.
I thought maybe, I don't know.
A little of both, I'm pretty sure. Listeners, fact checkers.
Fact check this.
Tell us. We'd love to know. Hannibal says that she has to allow herself to love him the way he loved her. And she gets up and slits his throat.
Yes.
And creepy embalming fluid throat slitting.
This gushing out. Ugh.
That was a little queasy making.
I was really intrigued by the line, what you need of your father is in your head. It's subject to your judgment, not his. But I felt Hannibal was talking about Will. Because what Hannibal needs from Will is in his head, and it is not up to Will whether or not he gets to have that place in Hannibal's head. He's there.
Interesting.
It's just a thought. What do you think?
I don't know. I was mostly thinking that it was getting her to separate herself from her father in this accepting of Hannibal in that place. And also, it's very common for children to feel that they have to change or do something based on their parents' judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And by saying that your father's judgment is just in your head, there's no more judgment anymore.
That's
so
true.
If you let go of that and you stop listening to that judgment that you've heard from your parents all your life, that will free you to make this decision. It was almost like by having her sort of symbolically have this moment with her father, and then saying, "Okay, now it's time to silence the judgment, and now you make all the decisions, not based on anything." Like, don't sit there and go, "Well, would Dad think this was a good idea?" That is just a voice in your head, and you need to silence that.
I guess in a way, making a space for Will and Hannibal in Abigail's world by removing her father.
Oh, that's true.
Exactly.
And removing his influence.
Yeah.
Did it bother anybody else that Hannibal didn't put newspaper down or plastic wrap on his lovely chair?
Just let embalming fluid go all over the place?
that immediately made me uncomfortable. That because I mean, I suppose Hannibal could just go buy another chair, and I guess we didn't see the floor.
Yeah,
but it just strikes me as messy.
Yeah, and again, I think this is, you know, movie magic. In which
Hannah magic,
exactly. More Hannah magic, in which we just have to imagine that perhaps there is
a cleanup method.
A drop cloth on the floor.
I want to imagine American Psycho level of
that's
newspaper taped to the floor, just really ready.
It was not like that. You could tell.
It was not like that.
I'm trying to remember. There's a mob film where someone comes into the room. And the entire floor of the office is covered in plastic. And he tells the guy that it's there because they're doing some work in the room. But during the course of a conversation, you find that it's really there because the guy's going to get killed. And that's what I was thinking.
Work,
exactly. So I was imagining some plastic that had been rolled out underneath and under this chair. Yeah.
I mean, maybe he figures, you know, Mason Verger stabbed the other one, so I'm going to have to replace these anyway.
Yeah.
Or maybe that was the chair that Mason stabbed, so he's going to have to, I don't know.
I don't know, maybe he picked it up in a thrift store and just used it for the tableau. I don't know.
He found a match.
Right.
So the last scene we get with Abigail, and this is why I think the Abigail flashbacks are a little odd, because it feels very abbreviated, but we get the Hannibal cooking getting the they know call, and he tells Abigail that they're coming, and Abigail gets first excited, then panicky. So are we going? You know, we're waiting for Will. It's important that he sees you. I want you two to be together.
Yeah,
I didn't know how to read Hannibal's tone here.
You don't like what he's implying?
Well, I mean, it's odd because I did really believe that Hannibal felt they could leave together and had every intention of them leaving together. But it's when it's clear that Will told everybody.
Yeah.
And they were coming. Mm-hmm. That's when that game's over.
Yeah, he had a drastic change of plans.
But he did still call and warn Hannibal.
Yeah.
He couldn't help it.
Yeah.
He didn't know what he was going to say until he picked up that phone.
And Hannibal says he's sworn to look after her, and she has to look after him now. We need to protect each other in these new lives we've created.
Again, very Chio-like.
Yes.
In the, you know, will you look after me?
You've hunted with your father, and now you're going to hunt with me.
You hunt with me, yes. It's almost like they could have just walked away.
They could
at
have.
That moment.
Yeah.
But the thrill of the hunt.
Well, he still had to give Will a chance somehow.
still had to see if Abigail would push someone out a window, I guess.
Exactly. This was the test to see if this family could actually be a thing.
And he was disappointed by everybody.
Oh, yes.
By everybody. Except Dr. Bedelia DeMore.
There you go. It's like, you know, all those other people, losers.
Yeah.
Bedelia, you won the contest. You get to go.
It's like The Bachelor.
Right.
Hannibal's just knocking through people, telling them they're gone.
Just instead of a rose, you get somebody's heart.
This flashback collection makes me wonder if we're going to get more stuff like this season. I mean, we knew they would have to pad the runtime a little bit with things, because 6 40-minute episodes to do Red Dragon is a lot-ish.
Ish, depending on what you want to cut out.
Or what you want to add.
Right.
Yeah. And how much you're drawing from different places, too.
Very true.
Yeah. Well, Hannibal is alone in his memory palace here a lot more than he was when he was on the run.
Right.
So anything that reminds him of these memories, like Will coming in with the scent of a family.
So you look at this as Hannibal is flashing back. This is not for our benefit.
No, I don't think this is for our benefit.
Okay.
I don't think there's anything that we're going to learn or discover that we didn't. I mean, it might be parts that we didn't necessarily see, but it does mm-hmm. definitely seem like we're seeing what Hannibal bides his time with.
Sure. And we do this in this episode in a very theatrically showy way. Multiple times our transition is one character as the background blacks out.
Yes.
In a very stage. You know, if I were writing flashback in a stage production, it would fade down everything but the guy having the flashback, and then we'd fade up on the flashback and get some light on there.
It's very theater-like. Very on theater. Stage, yeah. All the lights go off behind you, and then you've got a spotlight.
And they're alone
face.
In the spotlight.
And it's a new type of transition that we haven't had before. How did that work for you two?
I loved it.
I loved it too. I thought it made what we were focusing on very clear.
The only thing I didn't like about it is I'm looking forward to seeing the Blu-ray, but the version we watched, it felt like everything, all the blacks in the people were slightly gray, and the background was black. So it more looked like someone cut them out with scissors.
Oh, yeah.
Than a natural, like, I wish it had looked more like they faded the lights down.
Yeah, and but instead it was done in post.
Yeah, it was clearly a post-production decision.
We did have to deal with the consequences of that.
Yes.
And I did notice that. Sometimes it was worse than others.
Mm-hmm.
There were times where it was really obvious that the person looked cut out.
Right.
But again, I do that mental thing of no, I love what they're trying to do with it.
Right.
So I'm going to let go of that and not let that bother me as much because I loved the intention of it.
Right.
Of how usually it would happen too when someone would either think of something very significant or something significant had been said to them.
It's a far better transition than looking off.
Yes, exactly.
Into the memory.
Which they did a lot. Yeah. Like in the first, you know, everyone had the window.
Jack Crawford's memory flashback look off spot.
The look off spot. But I thought it made people almost seem like they were suddenly lost in their own thought or in their own moment to have the background drop off. And there were times that happened. There was one time where it happened with Hannibal where it was all black in the background and then his eyes went black.
Yeah.
And it was startling. So I loved it for as technically nuanced as I wish it was. They did the best they could.
You were able to see their intention.
Yes.
Rather than the reality of
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And I think we're all okay with some concessions like that. There's another one in this episode that I'm going to talk about a little later. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. Where we pick up where we left off, slightly where we left off in the last episode. Because rather than... So the hellos that happened at the end of the last episode were not the first words spoken by Hannibal Lecter to Will Graham. It was the traditional opening in Red Dragon. That's the same atrocious aftershave you wore in court. Mm-hmm. And this is not the first time we've heard almost that line.
Yes.
The
fact that it was, though, the specific atrocious aftershave line, I did get excited.
I got excited, too, but it made me nervous because there are a number of things that have already happened on the show that happen in Red Dragon, and I'm worried we're going to just get that again.
I
thought a lot about this in season one because season one seemed to be grabbing Red Dragon lines all
everywhere.
Over the place.
Everywhere.
It's like, well, okay, if you're going to use all the dialogue in Red Dragon, what are you going to do if you get to Red Dragon?
Right.
And I'm sure Brian Fuller was like, fuck that. None of my shows ever make it past a season. I'm not getting to Red Dragon.
Now we're at Red Dragon and we're like, oh, yeah. Shit. What do we do now?
I mean, the line in the book is specifically because Hannibal learns something from it.
Mm-hmm.
First, he demonstrates he smells Will, and then it's all about, hey, you have a kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important.
I got something on you now. And I think here it's still important because now he knows what Will's been up to, and it does. It gives him sort of a leg up on Will. Mm-hmm. I know what's going on. Oh, you have some great...
The shaving lotion is something a child would select, probably with a ship on the bottle.
It's all weaknesses. Mm-hmm. He's finding weaknesses. He's finding weak points. He's finding things he can manipulate, things he can, you know, control, you know, try to control Will with later on.
Right, yeah.
I know. That's why I'm like, I'm trying to be careful. No spoilers. So I don't mind. But I get what you're saying because I went back. I've read Red Dragon like ages ago when we were first starting this. So I was forgetting a lot of things. So I didn't get a chance to reread it, but I did like some skimming and went through plot synopsis and stuff like that. And while I was doing that, I was having that same thought. I was like, oh, well, wait a minute. Now this person is doing that. That can't happen because that already happened here. And that person is dead. And so it was. I was like, okay, this is going to be really interesting because how do we now piece together this storyline when you have already essentially cut pieces of the book out and placed them elsewhere? But I'm optimistic because so far I've loved the way Brian Fuller has cherry-picked. And there is still other books to choose from. So I'm hoping that he will fill those gaps in with some very interesting stuff that if you've read all the books, you'll be like, oh my God, that's really cool. He made that work. So I'm excited to see how that works.
I really loved how, for lack of a better word, bitchy Hannibal was about, did you read my letter before you destroyed it? Or did you just toss it in the fire?
There's a lot of like hurt ex-girlfriend here.
There is.
And I very much, it's sort of, you know, it's like, you know, do you ever think about me? Did you care that I even like handwritten note? No, I bet you just tossed it aside. He even has like a moment where when they're talking about how he's calling him Dr. Lecter.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he's like, I'm more comfortable, you know, the less personal we are.
Oh, yeah. Hannibal's face.
Just hurt.
Well, and it's really an interesting Hannibal we're getting to see now. Because not only are we seeing the hurt Hannibal, but we're also seeing mean Hannibal.
He gets mean right after
and
this.
And I really like that because there, you know, the one thing we had not yet really seen... You know, we've seen a lot of erudite Hannibal. We've seen person suit Hannibal. Now Hannibal's caught, so he doesn't need to hide anymore. And now he can just be mean.
Yeah, the gloves are off.
Because ultimately, what are they going to do? I mean, Alana says some stuff, and we'll talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
But ultimately, what are you going to do, arrest me more?
Yeah. Even when he's doing that, you know, asking him about the things that he can smell... I smell this. Although I had a bit of a giggle because he says, I smell pine.
Yes, dogs and pine and oil.
And all I can think of was Adam's Family Values when Mr. Adams goes, the scent of pine. And that like disdain when they're at the camp. It sounded so much like that, like pine. Like, ugh. Like everybody else would be, oh, it's so fresh. And they're just like, ugh, no. I don't like that fresh smell.
Really, what Will should do if he doesn't want to betray anything is just wear an air freshener around his neck. It would overwhelm
in the shape of
Hannibal's,
a pine tree.
Yeah, the pine tree, specifically the pine tree air freshener. But not just a pine air freshener. I think it should be something awful like cherry. And just,
tropical,
you know, he'd walk in and Hannibal would he
new
couldn't
car
even
smell.
Handle it. Yeah, couldn't even handle it.
New car smell.
Yes. We continue with our juvenile oral sex humor.
Yes.
By talking about the pencil lickers that is all the visitors that Hannibal seems to get now. And the disdain with which he says pencil lickers is lovely. And here's where he talks about the, you know, do you have a child in your life, Will? You know, I gave you a child.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to flash back to it in a moment just in case our audience doesn't remember. But I totally gave you a child.
Because, you know, if you would have been a good father. Are you a good father now?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to be a good. I knew that before you even. Yeah.
We get good use of reflections here when
we do.
Going back and forth. You get the reflection of Will on one side while Hannibal's talking and vice versa.
And it's at once the best way to shoot someone who's behind a plexiglass barrier is to use their reflection so they're both on screen at once. And it's also a lovely homage to Jonathan Demme's work in Silence of the Lambs, which really pioneered that way of shooting. And it was used in all sorts of prison movies after that.
I loved the way it also showed Will and Hannibal, not just on screen together, but almost like one is like a soft focus reflection of the other. Mm-hmm. And how we've sort of been doing a lot of reflections of each other, dual images, whether or not they're the same person, how we've even melded their faces together before. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful moment where Hannibal in this particular scene, when he's talking, he's all in silhouette. His mm-hmm. face is obscured, and we see Will's face next to his in the glass. And then he steps forward, and we do the reverse angle,
yeah.
And you have Hannibal's face now clear with Will, you know, almost sort of in shadow. His face is seen, but they kind of go back and forth and they keep coming closer and closer until their faces are sort of side by side on the other side of this glass. But what's going on is they're very terse mm-hmm. and very uncomfortable conversation in which Will is saying, I want no part of you.
Well, and I love that. I expected more of you, doctor. Your routine is old hat.
Old hat, yeah. Yes.
And that's right after Hannibal says, genuinely seems hurt because Will does the perfunctory, I thought you'd have some ideas about how he's picking them. You just came here to look at me.
You should look at yourself. Yeah,
came to get the old scent again. Why don't you smell yourself?
Yeah, that was nasty Hannibal right there.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
And Hannibal will help him because while family values may have declined over the last century, we still help our families when we can. And you are family, Will. Whether you like it or not is the button on that sentence that totally. Is left unsaid.
Completely. And that's one of those moments where the darkness fades to black in the background. And I really felt that his eyes were completely obscured.
And it's one of the few moments where Hannibal is actually lit as though he were in this cell, where it's all lighting above him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great moment there.
I found it was dark in his cell a good majority of the time, and I thought that was an interesting choice. I know looking at practicals in that room, there aren't a whole lot, so I can see why it would be underlit.
Well, there's nothing on tables. Certainly.
Yeah, exactly. So I can see why it would have to be so underlit, but yeah. It was very interesting to have such darkness back there.
So we have confirmation that Alana is now in charge of the Baltimore State Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay, I want to know how you two feel about Alana in general at this point. I mean, we've talked about how she was dramatically underserved by seasons one or two, basically relegated to the girlfriend part.
Mm-hmm.
How do we feel about her relegated to Chilton's part?
Yes.
I like it. I like her in Chilton's role better than Chilton in Chilton's role.
I mean, I think it's a great performance. I think it's a great role. I'm not sure I feel the transition from who she was before to who she is now. And I don't really get behind the, it's bone marrow in her blood. She thinks differently now. So, you know.
Right. Well, you know, sometimes things change when you get pushed out of a window.
I'm going to go more with that. And
the
more with
defenestration?
The jilted, I could never have understood you.
Yeah.
The, I'm going to keep my promise. The entire development and breakdown of her relationship with Hannibal and everything that came afterwards. I think that could definitely turn her into this character.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, what she's gone through with Mason Ferger.
Yeah.
and being out there. You know, there's probably a lot we didn't see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't know what her experience was there.
She at least got close enough to Margot. So if Margot told her anything about Mason at all, anything.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure they've had long conversations about Mason.
Exactly. I mean.
And even Margot's conversations with Hannibal.
Yeah.
So she may just have a whole lot of ugliness in her head.
Sure.
Right now.
Well, and this is an example of things happening off screen, transitions happening off screen. You know, there was a lot of discussion on Twitter, on our back and forth with us on Twitter and on our website about, you know, Will is sitting in front of La Primavera with Hannibal, smiling at each other. You know, it's nice to see, you know, it's that wonderful little reunion moment. And then at the end of the next episode, it's, I don't want to know you anymore. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out, well, it's like, well, you know, you think your buddy was someone, and then he tries to saw the top of your head off to eat your brains.
Yeah, deal breaker.
That might be the last straw. I mean, that would
Thin
be the last straw for me.
Between love and hate.
that is the line,
that's
the one
line.
On Will's
the
head.
The one, literal.
Did you notice the scar
been,
on Will's head?
That has been drilled into your skull.
Yeah.
That's the line right there. crossed it and we're done.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like, okay, this is the last time you try to cut me open, Hannibal.
Right.
The last time.
I could forgive you all the other times. This... It's the last straw.
I like the discussion they had where he talks about how Hannibal felt like a fly flitting around in the back of his skull, and that he had to stop and make sure that Hannibal hadn't followed him out.
Yes.
Because it's very telling about what Will is unleashing again by going to visit Hannibal. It's, you know, in the books, it's just getting back into a mindset, but... That Hannibal and Will didn't have a great relationship.
No,
they had
they
a perfunctory relationship. And so it was going back in to see someone who really, really hates you because you put him in jail.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he gutted you. So it's not, there's no love lost there.
No, no, definitely not. There's a lot of water under that bridge.
Yes.
<you know?
laughs> Alana knew immediately that Jack was going to try to shove Will back into this, and Jack is really manipulative.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the manipulation, and I don't know how I feel about that, because
I feel like he wouldn't have gone back to being this manipulative after all the things that we've seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's not enough from what I've seen in this episode of Jack to make me feel like he really is using his last ditch effort to catch the Tooth Fairy. I feel
because he does come in all smiley talking to Hannibal, like, hey, got your boy back. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like maybe if we saw Jack like tormented over these killings, or have him be using every other possible resource, every other, you know, a profiler, whatever, before finally going, all right, well, I have no other choice but to call on Will.
Yeah.
Then I would be like, okay, all right, I can see him.
I think what it is we're really
to get Will back.
We're really only seeing things that happen directly to our leads now. They've cut out all extraneous things. If it's not happening to Hannibal and Will, or now Francis Dolaride, we don't see it unless they're interacting with it.
So we don't see a personal moment.
And I think that's why we didn't see much about Potsy. That's why we didn't see much between Alana and Margot earlier this season, because it's not directly attached to our leads.
To our leads.
So then, hypothetically, this could be going on in the background, and Jack really did try everything else.
Sure. I think it's just the smugness that...
The smugness does, and I don't know whether that's
because it's almost daring Hannibal to do something,
or it's a front to get Hannibal to do what he wants him to do.
Yeah,
to work
to work with Will.
I don't know.
You either
trying to manipulate Hannibal.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jack's always jacking up the law.
Yeah.
You know, he could be trying to, you know, manipulate Hannibal. He's been through a lot.
He has been through a lot.
He may just feel like he's, you know, it's like I can do anything at this point. I've lost my wife, everything. I lost my job for a while.
I got it back.
I got it back. Hey.
You know, and I think the reason, you know, there was also a lot of contention over why Jack has his job back. But the moment a major serial killer shows up, maybe the FBI's like, you know that division that Jack Crawford ran? Maybe we need that back because we got a big bad serial killer going around here.
The Twisted Mind Museum.
Yes. Maybe that's where Jack's been hanging out, in his museum.
In his museum. That's kind of what I was going with.
Yeah.
You know, the whole idea of, oh, well, they're just going to, you know, focus on terrorists. You know, there are little serial killers are no big deal. But I think the sort of scope of whole families.
Yeah.
And also you're now not getting into isolated people who might be drifters or young people who are
it's way beyond the scope of local jurisdiction.
Affluent families.
Yes, definitely affluent families.
Once you start getting into affluent families, the government is like, okay, right. We got to stop this. So
we get more information about Alana's relationship with Margot here, and Catherine DeVernis even gets to say my favorite line from probably the series, a verger baby.
I love that
she gives
that.
It the same kind of aplomb that Jason.
Verger baby.
And I like the dismissiveness of Will. Well, good for Margot.
Right.
She's like well, no, I carried
good
him.
For me.
My
I
son.
Carried him. My yeah. He's the Verger heir.
Yeah. Basically, it's like, you know, I'm sitting pretty. You don't have to worry about me.
And Alana is very confident. In this episode,
oh, yes.
Very in control in this episode. And it's the kind of hubris that doesn't usually do well when around Hannibal Lecter.
No.
So when she says, there are only 5 doors between Hannibal and the outside, and I have keys to all of them. And then even digs in further with the he who sups with the devil needs a long spoon.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There's a lot. Everything about the person she's become here, even the way... She's dressing now.
Yeah.
You know,
well, she gets her Beetlejuice.
The striped coat and the white pantsuit underneath.
Low cut white pantsuit.
Yeah, very powerful. We've seen this in the first half of the episode where a lot of her stuff, she's gone from the patterns and the softness and
to severe and almost Hannibal-like.
Her hair down and flowing to like pulled to one side and styled and
it's
very
more severe.
Sleek.
Yeah. She went from the nearly makeup-less, you know, very natural in the first season. And now
she has dramatic
the
makeup.
Red. Yeah. This is a completely evolved character that is strong and forceful and is not taking any shit from anybody at this point. But that is scary because... That kind of overconfidence
is exactly what gets people killed.
Yeah.
Let's put this out there to the audience. We have no idea. Alan Bloom is a minor character in Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. Very, very minor in Silence. Mm. So we don't know anything here that our audience doesn't know. So we're not even... coyly speculating spoilers when we know what's to come. It's just, well, come on.
Yeah. And I just, the more I watched the episode and the more dialogue that was very Chilton-esque from, I was like, oh, okay, I can see why we did this because we wanted to give her something to do here. We didn't want to say goodbye to this character.
Right. And theoretically, Chilton's still about to get in trouble about the book he wrote about Hannibal.
He's going to come back, but he doesn't get as much screen time as Alana does.
Yeah.
In the hierarchy of who gets a lot of storyline on this show. So, unfortunately, I think a lot of what would have been exclusively Chilton has kind of been rewritten for her and giving her this arrogant... sort of character is to me seems really in line with how she has to deal with Hannibal and the things that she says to him and the way she threatens him. It makes more sense. If she didn't evolve like this, the way she was threatening him and the way she was talking to him and all those things that happened later on in this episode, mm-hmm. we would have been like, what the hell is that? That's not Alana. You know, we needed to see this.
Absolutely. So we're back with Will and Hannibal. I think Will just, you know, went to hang out with Alana but to cleanse his palate, make Hannibal think he was leaving.
Right.
And goes back mm-hmm. in. And we again get stuff. This is so faithful
yes.
to the book, and I love it.
Because I was so excited.
The adaptations have not been tremendously faithful to this book. Right down to the exact phrasing, this is a very shy boy, Will.
Yes.
And I would love to meet him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The interplay with him is so great here because they're standoffish at the beginning. And this sequence is probably my favorite in the episode. Just like in the last episode, the sequence where Will is doing the "this is my design" part. Mm-hmm. That is one of the best sequences of it. And Hannibal throws out the perfunctory, "have you considered he might be disfigured?"
Yes.
And Will's even trying to play, "yeah, okay, give me more. That's interesting." That's not interesting.
Right.
You knew that.
Well, what's really interesting is how we go in. I mean, we start this scene with sort of fascinating to have the closed doors, then the doors open. Mm-hmm. You don't really know who's walking yeah. through until
it's
Hannibal
very much
addresses
like
him.
The curtain parting
yeah.
at the beginning of the season. It's here's a... And the scene opens.
And the scene opens, and yeah. we push in, and Hannibal starts talking, and he's sitting at the desk, and basically he's like, okay, here's all the information. And then when we do the reverse, we're in the office.
Right. Oh, yeah. The yeah. transitions in this episode from location to location, it really makes me understand how they're doing this. You know, there was a lot of concern about how this show will be when Hannibal is behind bars. Mm-hmm.
They
so to have them go to the office, which is their place mm-hmm. where they had all their conversations. And when Hannibal says, could you see yourself in their eyes, Will, the glass
yes.
and the first small bond to the killer itches and stings like a leech.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And yeah. You know, and then they have that great moment. And then we have the background turns to black, but then they're in the house together.
And when Will looks into the broken mirror and that piece falls away,
yes.
part of his face falling away, and then Hannibal picks up the piece of the mirror and we see the Wendigo in there.
Yeah, reflected in it, yeah, when he tilts it.
And so that, you know, if we continue with the idea, and I think it's probably the most logical explanation, is that the Wendigo represents the dangerous part of Will's relationship with Hannibal. Will seeing that reflection, seeing that momentarily, is his mind telling him, okay, this is what you need, but be really careful.
Yes, because you're playing with fire here.
Yeah.
And it is a lot of parallels between he's talking about how the mind of the serial killer works. And it's almost like we're reminding everyone that the person who's talking has the mind of a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget how dangerous that is and how it's kind of, and it's also a beautiful way of having Hannibal impart the information
mm-hmm.
that
while still playing his games, because
mm-hmm.
this Hannibal, we only glimpse briefly in Red Dragon. This Hannibal is very much a product of Silence of the Lambs, where he's piecing out the information he can give while then turning it around. So when he talks about how Dolaride's choosing his victims,
yes.
well, how did you choose
how
your
did you
family?
Choose your family?
A ready-made
exactly.
wife and child. And the most cutting, you can't be allowed to breed.
Oh, you know better than to breed.
Because you don't want to pass on
yeah.
those
the
traits.
Biological responsibility.
Yeah. yeah. yeah.
Now, I want to rewatch this again because mm-hmm. I didn't see Will seeing the Wendigo. I saw Hannibal
seeing the Wendigo,
seeing his reflection as the Wendigo.
See, I just assumed it was Will seeing it because we've never gotten any indication that Hannibal.
It looked like Hannibal was like holding it, looking at himself.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
Well, could
be. I got the same thing.
Okay.
So I'm like, whoa, this is, I mean, I underlined it in my notes going, hey, wait a minute. What I saw is
Hannibal picks up the piece of glass and then turns it towards Will so Will can see it.
Mm. The way the shard is being held, it's just turned up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, I have to bring in production. In order to do that shot.
You don't have to be embarrassed about bringing in production, you know.
Okay.
It's part of what our listeners like about our show.
I know. It's just, I feel like sometimes when I ruin what could be wonderful magic and meaning.
Hey, I already talked about how it would have been nice if the transitions had been done better instead of digitally in post.
That's true. So you went down that line. I just feel like I go down that line and I burst everybody's little magic bubble with, well, I don't think they did that to say anything. I think it was the limitations of how they had to shoot it. Because you have to have the shard in front of the camera. You have to have the actor's hand in front of the camera.
You can't be pointing at the camera because then the camera sees the camera.
Exactly. Yes. So the angle that the shard is at looks like it's angled to Will.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that is on purpose is I question. Mm. Because the visceral reaction I had to it and the way it was picked up and the way Hannibal was holding himself was that he was pointing it towards him, and he looks up, and you think you're going to see his own reflection, and you see the Wendigo.
I was expecting to see him. But
I think this entire thing is in Will's head. Will is standing there talking to Hannibal, trying to get this sense of the locations and everything involved. Will is the one who goes and sees the family playing. It's not Hannibal there with him.
No.
It's Will seeing it. This is not a memory palace thing. You know, when Will walks up to Hannibal in the Norman Chapel at the end of the last episode, that's Hannibal's version of the scene. Hannibal's in his memory palace. It is perfectly reasonable that Hannibal would be in his office with Will.
Mm-hmm.
Will is the one going to the location. Yeah. So if Will sees anything on location, Will just saw his face fall off.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's Will seeing all of it.
Oh, I'm sure. That's why I agreed that Will is also seeing the Wendigo in there, that he sees that, because he is seeing this entire scene.
Sure.
I just think that the intention was not that Hannibal was intending to show his reflection to Will, or that it was facing in that direction so that Will could actually see it. I think we're all sort of seeing this whole thing.
So then we have Hannibal looking out. What were the yards like? Why is there no description of the yards? And we're in the yards.
Yes.
I mean, this is the episode firing on all cylinders. Honestly, if this was a mini series all by itself, this would be really popular. This would be...
Oh, yeah.
It's extra tragic.
Oh, yeah.
That it has been canceled, and this is when we're getting this now.
This entire exchange... going over all of this and the changing of the scenes was spectacular. And then I got excited because, again, a lot of it is still coming out of the books.
Right.
And that whole idea
of... Pilgrim feels a special relationship with the moon, he might want to go outside and look at it.
Yes, I loved this dialogue.
And if one were nude, say.
Exactly. It's like, you know, you would want, you know, something, you know, show consideration to the neighbors.
Yes.
Which I thought was hilarious.
Well, and then we get the line, have you ever seen blood in the moonlight, Will? It appears quite black. This is probably one of the most memorable lines from both incarnations of the movie and from the book. And it was what made it so cool last episode when the blood looked black, because we were all like, oh my God, the moon, it looks black.
We get to see it. And we get to see it again.
And now we get the line.
And it's actually beautiful because you see Will's hand in the moon, and then it transitions to him.
Will covered in blood.
Covered in blood. With blurred.
Well, and a whole lot of people thinking, hey, maybe that Blu-ray is going to give us some butt crack. You know, Brian Fuller has already promised some Richard Armitage butt crack on the Blu-ray. So
we're not going to get any Hugh Dancy?
Well, no one asked him about that because that was in the trailer for the season. Hugh Dancy was not. So who knows? Looking forward to those producer's cuts on Blu-ray.
That's one Easter egg I'm looking forward to.
Did you notice we got a musical cue from season one that's sort of beat-driven, whirring music?
Yes.
It may even have been from episode one. And it's when Freddie is taking pictures of Will leaving the hospital.
I did notice that.
I always get excited when we get these little musical cues from earlier in the series because the show does not really have tonal similarity. Right? Mm-hmm. It's very much an in-progress experience. Mm-hmm. You know, Brian Reitzel's score is growing and changing constantly, so it doesn't often recall old stuff. But we get two moments of recall, and that cue is definitely from the score for season one. It was not a new and modified version.
It was
version.
That deep, rumbling undertone that sort of almost underneath, almost unhearable, you feel it, that happened a lot in season one that we likened to a lot of David Lynch's work, that uncomfortable sort of subtone. And I was like, oh my God, we hear it. Yes. Really deep and uncomfortable.
And as we're seeing Freddie Lowndes for the first time since Mizumono.
Yes.
I know you two were probably very excited to see. I mean, is Freddie Lowndes your least favorite character or is that Dr. Chilton?
For me, it's Freddie Lowndes. I enjoy Chilton in his just
how about you, Ophelia?
I would say it's Freddie Lowndes just because I don't like, I don't know.
You don't like people who are bad at manipulation.
Well, no, I don't know.
Because both Chilton and Freddie are pretty bad at manipulation and way too confident in themselves. Well,
I think that's it for me. She has slightly more hubris, I think.
She did.
It's a tie. Yeah. They're pretty close. She's slightly more annoying.
Yeah.
With her hubris.
Chilton's a lot funnier.
He could be very funny.
Whereas Freddie's more sort of
and it's
grating.
Cute the way he wants to be Hannibal.
Yeah.
It's kind of cute.
It is adorable. It's like a little boy playing dress up.
It's like, you want to be a grown up. Putting your big boy pants on.
Exactly. Putting his superhero costume on. I want to be
a super villain costume.
Super villain costume. I'm going to have my own comic book someday. Whereas, yeah, Freddie. So funny that you bring up, you know, manipulation. I think what's annoying about Freddie is that she thinks that she's a sophisticated manipulator,
but she's really a tabloid journalist manipulator.
She's a manipulator with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
She's manipulating with a 2x4.
It goes back to I think it was. Yeah, second episode in season one, when she's talking to that cop who got fired about, hey, you know what? Wasn't personal. And then she gets that dose of reality when he gets his brains blown out right
all
in front of her.
All over her face.
Yeah.
Man, it's been a long time since we've watched that episode. Mm-hmm.
There was kind of a, you know, we get at least some funny stuff with Freddie. But, yeah, she definitely, when we saw her, it was like, okay, great. I did have that.
You were not thrilled.
I was
to get more
not thrilled.
Now you were, I'm going to guess, thrilled to get more Frederick Chilton in this season.
Oh, totally. I love to hate him.
That's the difference. You just hate Freddie Lynch.
I just hate Freddie Lynch.
I was really excited to see how Hannibal gets his cell examined. So the plexiglass, the little circle cutouts in the plexiglass are not just for air and communication.
Right.
He puts his hands through them to get cuffed. And I thought that was a really cool,
very well thought out
thing. You know, this brings me to an issue I've always had, a logistical issue that our listeners are going to be very upset with me about.
Uh-oh.
How does Hannibal shave?
Probably. He could be shaved.
Mm-hmm. Who gets close enough to Hannibal Lecter's mouth to shave him? Or is he actually drugged and put out every day or every other day to get shaved? Because in my legitimate imagination of this in reality, Hannibal would have a full beard that gets trimmed occasionally because why wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He could just be of a certain descent where he doesn't get facial hair. That does happen.
Okay, that's true. Okay.
There are people who don't get facial hair.
And there's electric razors.
There are
electric maybe they could have given him electrolysis. Yeah, yeah, they could have used like the epilator.
The Delco thing that they have commercials for every Christmas.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But still have, whoever's doing it has to be that close to his mouth.
You're worried about the mouth.
I'm more worried about him biting.
It's a different Hannibal than in Silence of the Lambs. This really always bothered me because we're told that Hannibal's always got this face restraint on because when he didn't, he
bit people.
Yeah. He ate a nurse's tongue. Yes. And in this universe, that role went to Gideon. But that means, so I guess maybe they haven't had to deal with ridiculously angry Hannibal Lecter who would randomly bite someone who comes near him.
He may not have earned the face
the face mask.
Yeah. The face restraint.
And that makes me wonder, are we going to get to see a face mask on Hannibal Lecter this season? I really hope we do, considering we may not get any more seasons. I really would like to see, maybe even the same one that was on Will in last season, because it's such an iconic part of this
character.
Story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of it, too, it's like... If you're going to do a half a season and change your lead's visage, especially one that has a lot of fans, it may be one of, again, hello, movie magic. There are like women on islands where they're.
Yes, yes.
They're perfectly shaved. Their legs look awesome.
Let's say on lesser. Shows?
Mm-hmm. Yes. On lesser shows? Okay.
I'm just saying
that...
Nobody has ever dealt with this issue. Hannibal in the book doesn't have a beard. It's really just a question that has always bothered me.
It's been eating at you.
Since the probably the second time I saw Silence of the Lambs, because the first time scared the shit out of me, I was not thinking about who shaves Hannibal Lecter.
I'm glad.
But, I mean, it is a legitimate issue.
It is a legitimate issue.
That the people who hate on me for calling the totem pole raising a legitimate issue, they are going to not like this one at all.
Oh, no. It is, like I said, it is a legitimate issue, but...
But who cares?
But who cares? Yeah. This is when, again, we prop up that window of disbelief and we just enjoy Mass with his clean-shaven face.
He would look good with a beard.
Maybe.
He looks good in general.
Yeah. Maybe he doesn't want to do it. Maybe he didn't want to go down that route. Who knows? There's a multitude of reasons.
It's like the same thing that took us from Abel Gideon with a goatee, which is even more extravagant to assume that they would do that, to Abel Gideon clean shaven when he comes back at the end of last season. Let's move on.
Exactly.
It's my issue. I recognize that. Okay. It's my obsessive issue.
You'll continue to toss and turn.
Instead, to another wonderful lesbian joke that they've managed to get past the censors.
Oh,
finger wagging.
You've come to wag your finger. I love a good finger wagging. Yes, you do. How is Margo?
I loved that. This is where there's a lot of quips here.
Yeah, it's a very Mason Verger line, but impeccably timed.
Yes.
And in
pause.
Yeah, like literature humor. Yes. It's not the kind of gutter humor that Mason Verger would have played. It's great to see, though. And again, it makes me wonder if NBC's just not in on the joke.
Yeah. They just don't get it. Because it's not blatantly obvious, and maybe that's the only way they'd understand it.
I like the before when all this starts happening, there's interesting sounds of the clicking and the knocking that's going on as we lead into this conversation between the two of them, especially when later on she says, I can see the cogs
gears.
Turning.
Yeah.
I can hear them clicking.
And Hannibal says, click, click, boom.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is so unnerving.
It's
because
very Joker-like.
That's because it's not just a clock ticking. Clearly, it's a bomb ticking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's everything from the finger wagging comment to the click click boom. It's just like the stuff we were seeing earlier. We're seeing Hannibal with more of an edge.
Yeah. Like he's spicy, he's sassy.
Yeah.
He is spicy.
And I see you're dressing Will in moral dignity pants.
Moral dignity pants.
Moral okay. dignity pants.
So are dignity pants diapers?
No.
Are you sure?
No. I'm positive.
I was imagining pair of trousers.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And not just trousers, but like fancy pants.
Yes, fancy pants.
Fancy pants.
Unfortunately, the image in my mind had moral dignity stamped all over.
So it's like Brian Fuller's Star Wars blazer that he wore to Comic-Con. Did you see his Star Wars blazer?
I have not.
Just has Star Wars written all over it.
Okay.
It's bright blue, has people's faces on it. It's
loud.
It's like the very definition of gauche.
Yeah. Okay. I want a Will action figure with moral dignity.
With
pants
moral
on.
Dignity.
Moral
pants.
Dignity.
Well, you could
pants.
Do what a lot of people are doing, which is just buying the Funko Pop Will action figure and modifying
it. Oh, there you go.
You know, in fact, I saw a modified Funko Pop character as Freddy Lounds. Because
oh, yeah,
there
I've
isn't
seen
a Freddy
that.
Lounds.
Yeah, there isn't
yes,
one.
I saw
so
that.
It's like people used to take the Simpsons figures mm-hmm. and then create all the characters that weren't being made as a figure until they just decided to make all the Simpsons figures. But I love that people are doing that because the Funko Pop line is so vast.
Mm-hmm.
You could find something that looks vaguely like what you want and then modify it. And at Comic-Con, there were all sorts of Hannibal and Will cosplaying Funko Pops. So there was Hannibal and Will as Star Wars characters. Hannibal and Will, it was just awesome. And again, I would love it if one of our listeners could make me a Funko Pop Mason Verger.
Yes.
Because I would like it.
You would love it.
I would love it.
You know, maybe it'll help him sleep at night, you know, instead of worrying about whether or not Hannibal can get shaved.
How is Hannibal
shaving?
That will
shaving? Silence that,
they
that
nair
maddening.
His face.
It's sad.
It's nair. They nair his
well,
face.
Well, and that makes sense. Okay, I get that. Yeah. That makes sense. It just, it strikes me as the most dangerous thing in the world.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like Barney
could
do
give
it.
Him nair. He could have nair.
Yeah.
Well, they could give him nair, yeah.
He can do it himself.
Yeah. Okay.
And nobody has
it's
to get nair's face.
I can move on.
Okay. I'm just giving you logic, that's all.
Did you like the double meaning in, I don't know what you're planning with Will Graham, but you're planning something. Why wouldn't you be? You've already cracked that lid.
Yes.
Can't resist pulling
it
back.
Pulling it back.
Yes.
And
a skull joke.
Are you suggesting I don't have Will's best interests in mind?
I love how he says, in my mind.
I'm stating it as fact.
Yeah.
Right. But then, yes, the moral dignity pants. That Will is in no way responsible for any of this.
Yep.
It's all Hannibal Lecter.
Yep.
But Alana's moment of control here is really, it cuts to the heart of Hannibal Lecter, and it is his dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that that's what it is, you know, and you're a little like a cat that way.
Like I love that. Yeah, that made
way.
Me laugh.
Cats are Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
They
would kill and eat you if they could.
And smile while they're doing it.
Yeah. Delightfully.
Right.
But it's not pain or solitude. It's indignity. I'll take your books. I'll take your drawings. I'll take your toilet. You have nothing but indignity and the company of the dead in your memory palace.
Yes.
But this speaks to the still very extreme cell that Hannibal Lecter has been given.
Oh, yeah.
It is still way, way more than he, quote unquote, deserves. But at least this speaks to the idea of we've given you this stuff. Now
Right. You're
going to play ball, because if you don't, you're going to be sitting in the middle of this room without even a toilet and a bucket.
Right.
And I will bring people in to look at you. Okay, so Will is in the Jacoby house now. Mm-hmm. He was in the Leeds house in the last episode. Now he's in the Jacoby's house, which is the house that he went to with Hannibal in the mine.
Yes, in the...
and he's watching the home movies on an iPad, which is nice. I like that they're showing that there is technology in this world. We also get that line about digital photography.
Yeah, yeah, I thought so, that was a good tip of the hat.
Technology does exist. We just choose not to use that type of technology.
Well, also, I have to remember, you know, Red Dragon came out in
1980.
Yeah, it was like 1981. 81, I'm pretty sure. It was 81. So, you know, that, there's a lot different.
Well, yes.
In technology. And I like how there are times where they kind of give a tip of the hat to that. Like, well, you could do it, you know, digitally, like little things like that. And things like seeing it on the iPad. And they do kind of use it, but I think they skim on it because there's so little of it in it originally. So they're kind of compromising.
And I like how seamlessly Will goes from watching this video to being there with the family having this birthday party. And it's so nice to see Will smiling.
Yes. Yes.
And really appreciating the family. It's he's able to step out of the horror of what he's doing. And this is what's grounding him. This is, you know, he's doing these horrible things. He's becoming Francis Dollar-Eyed, but he's still able to see the goodness that is represented by his family here. Mm-hmm. You know, he almost doesn't need the Raven Stag anymore because he's got personification of that. He needed it when he had nothing.
Right.
Except for Jack, because he's granite.
Because he's granite. This was a great sort of juxtaposition of all the previous, like when we finally have him going back and doing the pendulum thing and becoming, you know, seeing through the eyes of the killer again. Mm-hmm. It was really nice to see him sort of get a break from that. That he's still having that vision, but instead of dead bodies and blood everywhere, it was the family having that wonderful moment with the birthday party.
And it was a really nice thing.
It was really nice.
Then we get more with our favorite lab geeks, starting with the dirt and pine needles coming backwards off a box with the name Kate written on it. And then back at the lab, we see the box opened and a white cat revealed. I also am more fond of animals than children. So when Price gets all upset about the cat,
he gets very upset.
Zeller's like, seems like you're more upset about the cat than the kids, which one could say is a criticism that has been leveled at the audience for being more upset about the perceived deaths of Will's dogs than anything else. I also was probably far more concerned about that little terrier that ran off after the bear suit man than most of the other human characters on this show. But I love having it spoken. I'm particularly fond of cats, not particularly fond of children. Then we talk about the dog was stabbed, not shot as thought. And that I get that the dog was eliminating an early warning system. I don't understand how the cat was eliminating an early warning system.
Oddly enough, though, I think it is both a dog and a cat in the book.
It is. I just don't understand. I mean, cats are not warning systems. They
could care less.
Well, and if you hear a cat meowing, you don't immediately think there's someone in the house. You hear your dog barking downstairs in the middle of the night, you think there's someone in the house.
Maybe it was just
or your dog needs to go outside.
I want to eliminate any possibility of the cat getting in the way, the cat doing something unusual that might the cat reacting to a sound that the owners might, you know, it may be doing too much, but I don't think this person is thinking that, you know, rationally. But
we talk about what the two families have in common.
They were both happy.
So Will is back in the Jacoby's yard, and he's goes into the trees, finds a stump and sits on it. There are branches has been cut, looks over and sees a symbol carved into the tree. And we get a single line. I sat here and watched them.
Yes.
This scene in Manhunter was the scene where I couldn't handle William Peterson talking to himself.
No.
Because he just goes on and on.
What I thought of when I saw this, because I was like, oh, I remember this, you know, and it also reminded me of when he's in the woods watching Chiyo.
Yeah.
And that the two were very similar.
Observing.
Yeah.
When Will goes to leave, there's Freddy Lowndes. And here's the scene where we get to talk to Freddy.
Yes.
I was trespassing before the blood dried.
Yes, exactly. So proud of that.
But I loved Will saying, you didn't die enough.
Yes. Because she tries to act like they're colleagues. Well, that's one step
from saying, if I could have, I would have killed you.
Yes. We had to pretend you were dead. I really want you real dead, not pretend dead.
And Freddy snapped photos of Will's temporary colostomy bag, covering his junk, specifically, with a black box. A big
black
box. You're welcome. But here's where she says, not only did Dr. Bloom survive, she got rich. Lecter's living under her care. What kind of arrangement do you suppose they have? It was just a complicated one. Shut up.
Shut up, exactly. You're thinking too much. Go away.
But that sort of rationalizes the uncomfortableness with how nice his cell was in the first...
It does, yes.
The first time we see it. We're like, wait a minute.
There is an arrangement. It's just unclear exactly what it is. And Alana could say it's to get Hannibal to help with things. You know, it's to provide a place for people to visit with this very unique psychopath.
Which is Chilton-esque in its wanting to have people come and look at what she has on display.
It is. It really is. It takes one to catch one. Freddie's just speaking in tabloid.
Oh, totally. This is the thing.
A federal official told this reporter, are you referring to Hannibal Lecter or me?
Right.
I'll let my readers decide.
Decide. And a lot of, she's still trying to get in this whole idea of you could use me.
Yeah.
You know, psychopaths or narcissists. And, you know, Will is basically, you know, writing it off, but she does make a pretty good point there.
This next scene also could have been my favorite scene in the episode. Yeah. I loved Will talking to Molly. I love the way we transition in and out of Will and Molly being in the same bed.
Yes.
And I always loved this conversation in the book because it's so odd and sexual, but not.
Mm-hmm.
And just,
it's like, playful.
I'm feeling Randy. Me too.
Me too.
Randy's our new dog.
And then he's all like embarrassed.
But her discussion of Randy's huge balls
that they drag on the ground. Yeah. He has to retract them to run. Do you retract yours?
And that's where they come together because it's such light, fun relationship, sexy, the kind of conversation you don't just have with everybody, but. So then they're both in bed and Will's laughing. It's just wonderful to see.
I loved the way this was staged too, because she was sitting, you know, cross-legged on the bed, and she's kind of looking down, and Will was already established as, you know, sort of lying down, talking on the phone, looking up. And then when you see them together on the bed, they're both in those positions.
Yeah.
But because she's looking down, but she no longer has the phone and he's looking up, you not only get the illusion that this is what they would be doing if they were home together. This is what it feels like when you talk to, you know, to your partner or that person that you're really in love with and you miss them in that moment when you're on the phone, it almost seems like they're there. Because the way they were sort of not facing each other and looking down, it still reminded you that they were on the phone and they were separate from each other. And that was beautiful because it made their words and their bond so strong. You saw that in a beautiful visual, but it also was kind of sad because you realized that's what they want,
right?
But they're separated from each other.
And how quickly that facade vanishes when she jokes about how he had a criminal mind, even at that young age when he was trying to steal watermelon.
Watermelon, yes.
And then Will's just, I don't have a criminal mind.
Because watermelon's the criminal gateway.
And then they're back on the phone with each other. That breaks the moment. I adore that Will kept the dog.
Yes, of course.
I That's so great.
He kept asking about it, which was so that after a while they were like, okay, just Will, can you give up on the dog? Family's got it. Forget about it.
And we talked a little bit in the last episode about how Molly in the book and this character in television is the difficult, I want you to come home person. Why are you doing this person? And instead, it's like she's answering those criticisms with her line, I love you. I miss you. You're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's costing, but, and she's so matter of fact with it.
Yeah.
And I will be here when you get home.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry.
All of this reassurance.
Yeah. So it's all that much more jarring when Will awakens from his night terror where he sees Mrs. Leeds looking like an angel on the bed.
And then becoming the painting.
Yeah. And he's covered in blood. This is just like his old pattern. He's sweaty. He runs to the bathroom, and here's where he sees his face shatter, like the teacup, like the mirror we saw earlier. It's very unnerving. Yeah.
Did Mrs. Leeds have bangs?
It may have been Mrs. Jacoby. I'm not sure. They've gone back and forth.
One was brunette, and one was blonde.
Okay. Which one was the angel?
What I saw on the bed was Molly.
Oh,
because Molly has bangs, and that lady dead on the bed had bangs.
Oh,
very different hairstyle. So this whole scene meant something completely different to me.
I can look. There's a website that has screenshots. Should we look?
Sure.
Because
that's interesting.
Brilliant. Yeah.
I was like, no, he's seeing himself. Too much in the killer to where he's realizing it's a threat to Molly.
To Molly.
Because he goes to bed after having this conversation with her and wakes up in this nightmare.
Yeah. Which would make that moment even more frightening to him.
And that makes so much sense that would be what happened. Yeah.
It was so hard to see her clearly.
Well, it was covered in blood, and she had the mirrors. But I was like, the wives didn't have bangs.
No.
And there were distinct bangs over the forehead of the body. Because you're looking down, like, so it would have been like the head was here.
Yeah.
Looking over the bed, and I was like, there's bangs over the forehead.
Reviewing the screen captures of that scene, definitely that was Molly. Good catch.
That is an awesome catch.
Well, and that speaks 100% to Will's fear. He's doing this thing. He's in danger of becoming a monster. He's accused of having a criminal mind.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then Hannibal's been comparing his family to the family's Dolerite. Wow, that's dense.
Yes.
Yes.
And then to have parts of him fall away.
Yeah. Right, when he sees his reflection in the mirror. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. High five. So Jack goes to see Hannibal and is all smug as we talk to him. And I love as I live and breathe.
Yes. As I live and breathe. No thanks to you.
You're right.
Hey, you're looking good. You're dressing younger. I wonder if you've taken up a sport with a new partner.
With a new partner, yeah. It's like wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Sport.
And this is where we get confirmation of something that bothered me in the last episode, which is how did Will get Hannibal's note?
Yeah.
It went to Jack.
It went to Jack
and
first,
then Jack and forwarded Jack it to Will.
Well, I read it before my office forwarded it.
And Hannibal looks really pissed about that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how dare you
Those
read my
private,
private correspondence?
It's like reading his diary.
very accusative Hannibal here, too.
He is.
He's very, very...
Well, he's used to being able to dance around anything. And while he still has a surprising amount of freedom for the monster he is... I think it still surprises him when that freedom or that manipulative power he has is limited in such a way as the corporate overseer, Jack Crawford reviewing his mail before. I mean, he probably assumed Alana did, but Jack got it first.
And he kind of makes it even more sort of, like impersonal in that it wasn't I read it and I sent and I gave it to Will. My office did. So this whole
idea. And we forwarded it. I didn't even hand it to Will.
Right, right. So this idea that his, you know, beautiful letter, love letter, or whatever it was, is, you know, has been touched by the, you know, the hands of the peons.
Price and Zeller, who processed Hannibal.
There you go. I'm sure he does not like that idea at all.
We get a lot of food discussion here, that we're all in this stew together.
Yes.
And are you chumming the waters, Jack?
Back in the, you have back in the pot, letting him cook. We're all in this stew together. Yeah, it was a lot. Like,
but the line that really bothered me that Jack said is, Will has never been stronger than with you inside his head.
Yeah.
And that is manipulative bullshit, that is not cool.
And that comes right after Hannibal's very indignant, it takes two to catch one. Sort of like, don't forget, it's not just Will. Will is using me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm here. And yeah, and then Jack kind of like slips in, you know, like, well, no, Will has never been better, you know.
And you'll either play or you won't.
Mm-hmm.
But the great line is, Bella used to say your face was all scars if you knew where to look. There's always room for a few more.
Oh, and then the...
How much room does Will's face have?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's so many digs. Like, I'm going to cut your face open. And you remember when I used to talk to your wife about things that you didn't get to talk to her about? And... And, you know, maybe Will's going to get his face torn off again. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe.
Or maybe next time that he gets a whole bunch of scars, it's going to be all your fault.
Yeah. There's a lot of anger.
Yes.
And that's really great stuff out of Hannibal here.
And this is more of that sort of Mean Girls Hannibal we've been seeing throughout this episode.
As written by Tina Fey.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about Francis Dolaride, the Great Red Dragon.
Wow.
I was really, really nervous. We were about to get a flashback of young Hannibal. When we see the boarding house and the child and the out-of-tune piano. I mean, it was a little over the top, but it really... I'm hoping we can run out these last few episodes without learning any more about Hannibal's backstory. I want no more about it.
I know. I was surprised when you said that, because the minute I saw the table, I remembered,
his
background. Yeah, his grandmother ran the boarding house. I remember that this is something that they talked about a lot, was these moments, because it was all about how his grandmother acted with these people.
Yeah.
And the way she had these meals. And I don't want to give away a whole lot, because while I was watching it, and there's no dialogue, it's just the reveal of the table and very much him watching her and then her looking at him. And then when we go up from the child's legs,
we're looking at the legs,
and we come up and it's grown up.
And
grown up.
Not only is it grown up Dolaride, but there's still a plate of food to his left.
Yeah.
So we don't know if he's setting this table for his memory or if it's a transitional thing. It's a really nice touch.
Yeah. And when we got to that moment when they teased us with that little bit of his past, knowing we don't have a whole lot of time to get to everything in this episode, I was like, oh, are we really going to delve into what makes him like this? What are
all these
things?
I think we're going to start seeing that in the next episode.
Okay.
I feel like it's really interesting how they're piecemealing this out. I've been very impressed with how they're doing it, because it is a hard thing to adapt any novel into compressed cinematic way, but let alone having to plan for episodic in nature, you know, and this show is doing it in a very much, okay, we're just going to continue with where we left off in the next episode. And we end this episode the same way. It's just like, okay, we're going to pick up there when we come back.
Yeah.
But we had this sort of out of tune saloon piano going on.
It reminded me of,
A player piano?
Like calliope music, yeah. Like, you know, like we're going to see old, you know, you know, when you turned the crank, kind of old fashioned. It kind of made me think of that, like penny arcade music.
And it's sped up as we get dollar-eyed as an adult. Mm-hmm. Then he's watching these home movies of the Leeds and Jacobies with the glass in their eyes. And we see the dragon tattoo, hearing growling sounds, yes, that are not coming from Dollaride. We're hearing the monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved when Dollaride looks down and he puts his hands up over his head and then they turn into claws.
Yes.
And he straightens up, and he's done this once before in the first episode, where it's the moment he goes from in pain Francis Dollaride to the Great Red Dragon is when he stands up and he kind of cocks his head back.
You see all the muscles and ligaments in his neck.
Yeah.
And
what he does with his body.
Oh, it's amazing.
In these scenes.
Richard Armitage is doing a stunning amount of unprocessed work here.
And then, you know, and it is. It's like he's writhing and he's screaming, mm-hmm, and then that like calliope music is also has. It's like there's a weird plucking of strings, mm-hmm,
and you see him
happening.
Like do the head smack thing. That
it's the I get out of my head, get out of my head.
Oh yeah,
okay. And then behind him, there's a tail.
Yes,
I actually wrote
thoughts.
Tail? Question mark. Yep.
Well, I'm going back with this as a hallucination, but...
Well, of course, absolutely.
But...
I think it's a little much.
It was special.
I was really hoping for something more abstract like the Raven Stag. I did not expect to see a dragon tail in this episode. It's fine. I can go along with it. Just feels a little more on the nose than this show normally does.
Yes.
Yeah. I maybe the reason why they wanted to show it in that he is imagining himself as becoming,
mm-hmm,
and changing, that he is physically with all of this, you know, the way his muscles are perhaps. This is what he's envisioning in his mind. And I get it. We probably could have done it in a different way. It seemed.
It also does not look particularly like the tale of William Blake's Great Red Dragon.
No.
So, I mean, I'm going to withhold judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It was only a moment.
Yes.
It maybe lasted a second at most, but it was jarring enough that there's a movie called In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful, horrifying movie that's, mm-hmm, that's full of really, really visceral mental scares, except for one moment where they pull back the camera and there is a plastic monster coming out of the back of a guy's head. And it's, again, just a second, but it was enough of a second to be like, oh, well, that's cheap. Couldn't you have darkened the room a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe.
I got that with, what was it, Insidious?
The
where they show you the beast.
Where you finally see it, yeah.
You only get a glimpse of like a hoof or a little bit of fur or like a hand or a face.
And
then they show you the actual thing and I'm like, oh, really?
It's like,
yeah.
Darth right, Maul, am, come on.
I'm not afraid anymore. You killed it.
Very indicative of the power of imagining what this is.
Yes. Suggestion, the suggestion, the whole way that Jaws
even
worked.
The subtle growl is, mm-hmm, like...
Well, I think we're going to get more of that in future episodes.
Hmm. We got to get some wings. You think we'll get some dragon wings?
I would. You know what I would love to see? Shadows that are wings.
Yes, that would be cool.
A shadow where it's Dollaride's silhouette and it has a tail.
Okay.
I mean,
gotcha.
I would have bought that more. Yeah. That's very also in tune with the way we revealed things on the show before and the way.
This reveal did not feel like Hannibal. And it felt like something else.
And I think it also seemed a bit of a cheat the way they showed it,
mm-hmm,
because you see him, he does that the way he stretches his body and he gets his neck to kind of do all that, you know, and that looked really fascinating. And then, you know, we pan down
like
and then we
panel.
See like a table.
you know what it is?
Yeah.
It's Johnny Depp wandering around a hotel room in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas with a lizard tail.
You think that's it? We don't want to like make it even more fake by having it like actually come out of him. If we have like a carefully placed table,
it's cheap.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And I think this show is so rarely
cheap like that.
Yeah. If it had been like you said, a silhouette. If it had been maybe something in the room, mm-hmm. like the film tape.
Yeah, we've already had his transformation. Into the dragon with the film wrapped around his head.
Which was amazing.
Oh, which was a stunning moment. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think we would have bought that. If we would have seen something that was from a real life origin.
Yeah. I'm going to just say it right now. I really hope that the rest of the dragon does not look like that tail.
Okay.
Oh, that's pink and fleshy.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt like a Cronenberg thing. Like an upsetting Cronenberg thing. It felt like Videodrome shit.
Oh, I love Videodrome.
I hate Videodrome. We can have that discussion at another time.
Wow.
Again, I'm a little unnerved by the fact that there is a Tatler Crime paper edition.
Mm-hmm.
Unless this was just a special edition about Hannibal's capture that was released as a zine or something.
Yeah, I think because they kind of already set it up that she was just online.
Yeah.
If they had already, way back when, talked about it like it was a typical tabloid.
Right.
Because they do, those still exist.
They do.
They're still in the supermarket.
Oh, yeah.
And it is possible with the weird exclusives Freddie Lowndes got from the FBI that she could have pulled together something in a spectacular, like Time's Moment of the Year magazine.
I was kind of thinking that after all she'd been through, that having a print edition.
That was her victory.
It was sort of like a step up for her.
Yeah.
That instead of just doing it online, she could now be up there with all the other classic sort of tabloidy things because
she's finally elevated above the ranks of bullshit online
right,
reporter
to bullshit
paper
print.
Recorder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But also there's an audience for this stuff.
Absolutely.
That you can only
clearly
reach in print.
Francis Dolarhyde.
Exactly.
Because he does not go in for that digital shenanigans.
No.
I love the detail that he's lovingly touches Hannibal's face, and the ink comes off on his finger.
Does he touch
Will or Hannibal?
Will.
Okay.
It's Will.
Is it Will?
Yeah. Because the one side is Hannibal with the cut-up face.
Yes, right. With Hannibal's injuries.
Yeah.
And then it's Will, but there's like a black spot underneath Will's face, like a shadow, and that's what he like...
Yeah.
He touches, yeah.
He touches that. And then he wants to lick it.
Yeah.
And he has like a... Oh, like, no, maybe, I need to wipe that off somewhere
else. I think
he
does lick it. It looks like he did.
He almost
But first he
does.
Looks really, like, distressed by it.
Yeah.
And, again, we need to praise Richard Armitage's almost silent performance.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Just a
so
stunning achievement.
He's doing,
said.
Oh, exactly. Doing so much in the way his hands are moving, what's going on in his face.
Like, everything about it. He is... Francis Dolarhyde.
And I still need, I realized I forgot to write this note from his. I want to know what that location is.
Oh, well, I assume we're going to find out where he's working.
Yeah, because I know it's supposed to be,
Gateway.
You know, in Gateway with, you know.
Oh, is that the name of the place?
It's the name of the company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And if you've read the books, you know, he works
in a film lab.
In a film lab. And we know that now in this. But it's a very unusual break room lunch area
with the bright windows with
these gigantic stained glass windows.
Yeah.
But again, because
it's beautiful.
So they do so much beautiful things with light on the show.
Yeah.
It was so great to have him have these kind of scary internal moments with this.
It's beautiful,
window behind him.
But also still that sort of bleakness of a work cafeteria.
Yeah.
Because and the way he's dressed in it is almost prison. You know, he's got his shirt all the way buttoned up and it's bland. Yeah, it's really great.
Because there's really no color in those windows. It's just interesting that it's the big letters. And I just love how it hits him with a backlight in a way that makes him his face a little bit dark. I just like how they used it.
Absolutely.
And I think it makes these moments with him even more like intense.
So now we get to some of the people often will question who have not read Red Dragon. Mm-hmm. What makes Red Dragon such a great example of not true crime, but something elevated over your standard true crime or this type of book? Mm-hmm. And really, it's Frances Dolarides' interaction with Reba McLean.
Mm.
And it has been amazing in both of the incarnations we've already seen it in.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Allen played Reba in Manhunter. And Emily Watson played Reba in Red Dragon. And now Rutina Wesley, who's from True Blood, is superb in this role.
She's great.
It is hard to play blind,
yes,
convincingly, number one. And I love the way she speaks, the specificity of the way she speaks in, mm-hmm, this. From the moment she's reaching out to somebody, or to a coworker, that all she knows about him is he's the guy who writes angry letters to her department.
Right.
And his the very same, yeah, is great. But I love the way they revealed she's blind. You know, we learn she's blind at the moment Dolaride learns she's blind.
Yes.
When she gets up and feels her way to the plums, mm-hmm, and hands him the plums. And he asks for a favor in addition to the plums.
Right. Yeah. She has such a relaxed, like, warm,
yeah,
it interface is warm with him.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that not even with people that he works with or people that come in contact with him in daily life ever really treat him that way.
Right.
And you can see that he reacts to it almost immediately. My favorite moment is when she turns the lights on and he makes that first realization, mm-hmm, that she can't see, because he's actually waiting with his hand over his mouth.
Yeah. He's hiding his disfigurement.
Yeah. And the minute he makes that realization, the hand slowly comes down.
Because he can be himself.
He can be himself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not completely, obviously, no, right, but he can, you're, be, right, himself.
He can't be the Great Red
Dragon. Here's where we get you're better off shooting digital.
Yes.
If you're going to be shooting in the dark. I'm not a fan of that format.
Not many people are, yeah, here.
So it's a great nod to the fact that we are in a photo lab.
Mm-hmm.
His comment about wanting to photograph nocturnal animals in the zoo is unnerving, as it always has been.
Oh, yes, because that is straight out of the book. And it is. It always seemed to me, even when I was reading it, like, why? Who's going to let somebody just get into the zoo? And I know he, like, tries to explain it,
mm-hmm,
and everything. It did seem like, wow, this is kind of a lame excuse for why he's doing it.
Her comment about the more sensitive the film, the meaner it is to handle,
yeah,
is a great line about a lot of people in, yes, this show. And her offering to develop the film, privacy guaranteed, because she can't see it.
She can't see it.
Exactly.
But since it has to be done it's always interesting to hear this stuff about film and how volatile it is,
mm-hmm,
because we don't deal with film really anymore, almost at all.
No, most
of the viewers of this show probably have not really experienced how volatile film can be.
And it was great the way she, you know, describes it, you know, that you can't even use infrared goggles, which, you know, because of the radiation would destroy the film.
And speaking of infrared goggles, the beginning of this scene cheated total darkness, just like Silence of the Lambs,
totally,
did, with its little, it's just lit a little bit like this, but it's completely dark. Nobody, yeah, can see anything, but it's just lit a little
in
bit.
In fact, yeah, the only way you know it's completely dark is her dialogue.
Yeah.
Because at first I thought that
come
they were
forward
in semi-dark.
And you'll
steps, and there's a stool.
Which I love the specifics of that dialogue, because that also gives you a little glimpse into how she navigates the world. Is she knows three steps forward, and I will find tile. And when I find tile, over here there's a stool.
There's a stool, yeah, exactly. Yeah. The map that she has
in her mind. Which is an awesome thing that I know I never really thought extensively about. And Red Dragon was one of those first real encounters with how blind people navigate their world.
Mm-hmm. It also that how uncomfortable he is with how warm and willing to help.
Yeah, He's not used to helpful people.
Yeah.
He's not used to people who are nice to him.
Very suspicious, and he just kind of slinks away.
When he probably, because he is uncomfortable with his appearance, he doesn't let people get close to him, which makes them standoffish, which reinforces what he believes about how people feel about him.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a person who can't see him, so he's not on guard about that, to be genuine and honest and friendly with him, it's a unique experience for mm-hmm. him. So later after work, Dollaride is in his van and he sees
his creeper van.
Yes. It's a good thing you're blind van never get into it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like plain white crappy vans. Usually not the you want sidling up next to you on a dark night.
I mean, all it needs is the words ice cream written in black block letters with no ice cream pictures to be even more horrifying. How about the absurd dentist ad on that bus stop?
I got
open
a kick out of that.
Wide and say
How weird. And that is just Brian Fuller being so playful.
That's what I thought. It was a great sense of humor because you have the, like a scream and the wide open mouth. And we have,
nothing
you know, the
like
serial killer that
to make
bites
you want to go
people.
To the dentist. Too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, exactly.
For me. Anyway. and Dollaride offers to drive her home. But she says, you don't need to worry about me. I take the bus all the time. I'm not worried. Ride with me for my pleasure.
Oh, that was so uncomfortable.
That's from the book.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Manhunter actually improved it by having him say, ride with me because I want you to.
Mm-hmm.
Less creepy.
Yeah, slightly.
I don't know. Maybe she just wants to believe the good in people.
That's all I can think of.
But for my pleasure is probably the creepiest way he could have said it.
Exactly. creeper van. creeper.
I mean, at least he didn't say, ride with me for my pleasure in my unmarked white panel van.
Right. And it wasn't the way he said it. The way you can kind of write it off is that he is so awkward in the way he talks.
And at this point, she has already probably assumed he has a speech issue because of her experience with speech therapy. You know, we talk about it in this next scene, but I get that. It was really creepy.
She might think, oh, how sweet. This was the only way he could think about how to articulate.
Oh, he's so shy.
Yes. He must not do this often. He must really like me.
And she offers him a drink to get him to come in the house. It's like reverse serial killer here. It's like, come on in. No, I'll give you a drink.
I'll give you a drink. And she puts her hand on his arm.
Yeah.
Which was so forward. And I'm sure he's probably not used to being touched that way. Right. That was so powerful to have her put, her hand on his arm and then to invite. And then, of course, then they start with the creepy music and the entire time.
The long animalish moan of strings on the soundtrack there. As Dollaride is looking around to make sure he's
furtively,
not being seen.
Yes, furtively looking around. And then they follow that with this beautiful close-up shot of her hands touching the pie
and how
and
she finds
placements.
The place to cut. Yeah. This is another detail from the book that is, it's, there are really several moments with Reba's character in the novel and the movies that are just beautiful moments. And the finding the pie center with the toothpick and then being able to cut because now there's a toothpick in the center. It's so lovely. And her discussion about this is her first job on the outside, outside of what? The inside?
Yeah.
And how she trained people to live in a sighted world but didn't do it herself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so great. Dollaride gobbles that pie up, too. Just,
like an animal.
I don't have to worry about her looking at me. I'm just going to eat it.
Eat it.
He eats it the way we'd all eat pie if no one was looking at us.
No one was watching.
Alone. In the kitchen,
right
over the sink,
right out of the pie,
out of the pie.
Oh my god! So when she mentions speech therapy, Dollarite immediately changes. Mm-hmm. And he just basically just grunts and growls, asking me, do you cook?
I like how, though, she knew that what she was going to say was loaded with consequences.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when and she mentions...
That's how she got to that discussion that she wanted to have with him. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, oh, well, I wanted to go back to working with speech impaired children. Do you cook?
Yeah.
Just like immediately follows it up with something that has nothing to do with it.
Because either he'll react to it or he won't.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that answers her question.
Or perhaps we can change the subject to cooking.
Yeah.
Which I don't know whether or not she felt he had a thing for cooking, which is, you know, ironic in a show about a
cooking.
Serial killer chef. Do you cook?
Her, really, this is Rutana Wesley's best moments in the episode too, where she is so precise with, I understand you because you speak very well and because I listen. Mm-hmm.
And people don't pay attention.
Yeah.
And most importantly,
but I hope you
interested
do.
Yes. In what you have to say.
And then when she talks about why she likes him, because she feels no sympathy from him, sympathy feels like spit on my cheek, and I don't do self-pity. She is superb delivering those two lines. And I mean, the only place I've ever seen this actress is on True Blood. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel she did anything of nuance on True Blood. I don't feel anyone did anything of nuance on True Blood.
Exactly. So it's nice to see her do something that is wonderfully nuanced. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. Everything from the way she sort of goes right in and no nonsense, and let's talk and let's get. And
reaches for his face before, as she's asking, can I touch your face? Yeah. I mean, this is another moment where he crosses the line into almost terrifyingly creepy when he grabs her hand because she wants to know if he's smiling or frowning. And he's, trust me, I'm smiling.
It was creepy.
You don't sound like you're smiling.
No.
Especially since during this entire scene, they kept doing horror movie, something's going to happen stings. Constantly. After a while, I was like, will you stop it? Because it was psychologically making me think he's going to kill her right now. Even though it's like, I know this isn't going to happen. I know that, you know, they're not going to do that now.
Right.
This is too early in the season, you know, in these episodes.
We're not just getting one episode with Reba.
Exactly. There's going to go. But why do you keep doing this ominous horror movie music?
They're playing into the audience. Immediately assuming, like, this is the kind of, I love it when Hannibal plays to the, is the standard cheap thrill thing going to happen? And no, it's probably not, because it never has on Hannibal.
Yeah,
but it might. So our last scene of the episode is another one of those we begin and to be continued scenes. Hannibal gets a call from his apparently very creepy speaking attorney that this was allowed to just go through to him. I mean, I assume that Alana, like Chilton, has Hannibal's cell bugged and has every phone call he's taken recorded. But this is... That he convinced anyone he's Hannibal's attorney is a little...
Yeah, that was hard to believe. Hard to believe, too.
But this is great. Dollarite says, I wanted to tell you that I'm delighted you've taken an interest in me. Mm-hmm. I don't believe you would tell them who I am, even if you knew. The important thing is what I'm becoming, and you alone would understand that. And Hannibal, this is another moment where Hannibal's face is in that overhead light and his eyes are dark. Mm-hmm. And he's just not surprised by any of this. I mean, he talks to a lot of serial killers.
Yeah.
Hannibal. Mm-hmm. Tell me, what are you becoming? And here we get the great red dragon.
We cannot even convey because we can't manipulate our voices the way the word dragon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. It was growling.
And then we get to sit with Hannibal's face blank.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like he's not even impressed. He's just processing.
Yeah. Like, oh boy, what do we have here?
What can I do with this
curiouser
guy?
Curiouser and curiouser.
And then immediately, credits.
Yeah. Yep.
So next week, I imagine we're going to get to hear more of Francis Dalaray, the Great Red Dragon.
Yes.
Just talking with Hannibal before the credits.
Probably.
But man, you know, I was initially a little concerned about our return to procedurals. But they are nailing everything about this except a certain dragon tail.
Yeah.
That we will.
That's forgivable. It's
that,
small.
That is.
It was a moment.
If there's only one problem in this adaptation of Red Dragon, and it is the Red Dragon, which has never been adapted into the adaptations, mm-hmm. you know, they recorded Frank Langella as the voice of the Red Dragon in the Ralph Fiennes version in Red Dragon. It was almost all bits of Red Dragon were scrubbed from Manhunter, mm-hmm. the tattoo, all the talking to the dragon. So it's unprecedented, the Red Dragon in the media. So
yeah,
I'm nervous.
They're really bringing it up front and center.
Yeah.
And it is going to be interesting how much of this.
Yeah.
They give to us.
But considering the other two adaptations are severely flawed for their own reasons.
Their own
very different reasons.
So basically, if this is just less lame.
Less severely flawed.
Really, then the
bar is low.
Yeah. I mean, the bar is high for a season of Hannibal, but the bar is very low for a Red Dragon adaptation as far as I'm concerned.
That's very true. Right now, just all the physicality of it, all the
they're
stuff that
better.
Yeah,
it's the scene with Will at the crime scene and this episode between Will and Hannibal going from place to place, those two scenes alone are cementing this as a better adaptation. It is superb.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, I think what we're all concerned about is knowing that we may not go exactly on this ride.
Yeah.
The way the books have gone, it is, we don't know.
Right.
And there's a lot of apprehension there, but I feel like I say this a lot. It's like I've loved everything that's been cherry picked, and I've loved the way things have been put together. So I'm going to try and just like I'm staying with the optimism that they're going to give me something different. I'm probably going to be surprised, mm-hmm. you know, where they go with this, and I don't want to be disappointed at the end of this.
We have roughly 165 more minutes of a Red Dragon adaptation coming to us.
Yeah.
So while the previous adaptation things that Brian Fuller did, like Potsy, mm-hmm. felt very rushed, we know we have nothing but time for this.
Yeah.
So I have confidence.
Mm-hmm. We're going to do this one right.
So that's it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week with more of The Great Red Dragon. You can email us at info@eattherudecast.com. Follow us on Twitter @eattherudecast and on our Tumblr, eattherudecast.tumblr.com. Please continue to fact check us. We love it. And please answer the many questions we had about tonight's episode on eattherudecast.com. On the Life on the Swing Set, Swing Set FM pages for anywhere.
Yeah, our Tumblr, our Facebook page,
We love to hear from the audience. And we want to remind you that we also do a Twin Peaks podcast called Damn Good Podcast. And you can find that at damngoodpodcast.com. We will be returning to that after Hannibal is over.
Aww.
But before I just confirmed with Sean Coletti, the other half of the This Is Our Design podcast, that he is going to be joining us for our discussions about Red Dragon, the book, and the two film adaptations that we will be doing after this season. So I'm very excited about that.
I'm looking forward to that.
Miko, where can they find you online?
At Technogeisha on Twitter, Miko Technogeisha on Facebook. Technogeisha.com, and you can also find me at Life on the Swing Set.
Ophelia.
They can find me at Ophelia Tesla on Twitter, at Ophelia Tesla on Facebook, and Ophelia Tesla @gmail.com.
And you can find me at CooperSBeckett.com, at CooperSBeckett. We've all really made it convenient that our stuff matches.
Yes.
That's good. And I write for Life on the Swing Set. And my book, my audio book, My Life on the Swing Set, is on Audible now.
Woohoo!
So that's very exciting. So, you know, check that out. If you have Audible, it's audible.mylots.com. It's a lot more about sex than our Hannibal show.
A bit.
So
more.
You know, just a warning.
It's like,
read the description before you add it to your cart.
It's a not safe.
It might not be for you.
It's a not safe for work.
Oh, it is very much NSFW.
Yeah.
Very much. And we're very happy to have you back, Miko, at our table.
Aww.
Now, because we are all at the table and we're not messing with Skype anymore. It's lovely.
Yes, I'm not sitting in a hotel bathroom, not being able to hear you while my children sleep.
And now there's no more vacations, so we're not all watching the episode independently of each other and being like, man, wish we could talk about it.
Oh, like that Sunday that all you did was tweet all day about it? And they were like, well, maybe I shouldn't be tweeting. It's like, yeah.
It was too late, or we ruined it.
I tweeted zero spoilers, you know.
No.
You too, zero spoilers.
No, there was one.
Was there one?
Don't you remember?
I don't remember. But anyway.
Anyway, those days are gone.
Those days are gone. So, thank you, listeners, for joining us at the table.
Hey, this is Dan Savage from the Savage Lovecast and Savage Love, and you're listening to a Swing Set podcast at Swing Set FM.